to A Path Home. This is the podcast where we demystify the tasks related to after-death care through hearing stories from people who have cared for their own deceased loved ones at home. I'm your host, Sarah Cruz. I'm the director of Heartland Prairie Cemetery, a home funeral guide, death educator, and a member of the National Home Funeral Alliance. On today's episode, Anne-Marie Keppel shares the extraordinary life of her father-in-law, Marcelo, a political refugee from Chile who settled in New York City. Marcelo died in a hospital in Vermont on a snowy day in January of 2019. Anne-Marie made arrangements to have his body brought back to their home, where the family gathered to say their goodbyes. To begin, I asked her to tell me a little bit about Marcelo.
Marcelo, so I met him when he was in his 70s. So he had already had a very full life. And I think I got a very sweet side of him. He grew up in Chile in South America. And he lived there until he was in his 30s. And then the dictator Pinochet came to rule. And when Pinochet came to rule, anybody who had been against his rule was either imprisoned or tortured or killed. So he and his wife, who had become my mother-in-law, became political refugees and they fled the country. So he and his family members went to different parts of the world and Marcelo settled in New York City. And he ended up not with his own family there, but with others who had also fled for the same reason. And so they ended up with people who they were very close to. So he was a literature professor, a Spanish literature professor, and he loved going to theater and opera and ballet. And after he fled Chile, he traveled back and forth there a lot between Chile and the United States and Spain, and he was working on his education. And, you know, I came to know him as a wonderful person, but he had already been through so many hardships. He had lost an infant daughter. This was before my husband was born. And he had gone through a couple of marriages. So by the time I met him, he was in his third marriage. And he had had a long time relationship with alcohol, which in the end resulted in Korsakoff syndrome. And that played a role throughout his death as well.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah, Korsakoff syndrome is the result of a vitamin B deficiency, which is largely due to excessive alcohol drinking, and it causes confusion and memory loss. He had a very romantic view of life, and I said to him once, we were sitting outside and he was eating an ice cream. He had a very big sweet tooth, and I said, Marcelo, do you hear that bird singing? And he stopped and he listened and he said, and I did not hear it until just now. And now I cannot imagine not hearing it. And he has this beautiful way of framing things because English was his second language. And because he was a literature professor, everything that came out of his mouth was carefully articulated and just poetic all the time.
Oh, I love that. That's a wonderful story to just give you a glimpse inside the sweet, romantic nature of his world, especially after living through such difficulty and hardship, to have that artistic perception of the world around him.
Yeah, you know, he loved the art so much. And I think perhaps because he had such hardships in his real life, that escape into the beauty was something that nourished his soul. And it was always there. And I think as he got older, He preferred to stay there, especially since he stopped drinking. Just his relationship with the arts was so beautiful. Right up until the very end, like he didn't even like to necessarily say anything negative about anybody else. In fact, I'm not sure I heard him say anything negative about anybody else. Not to say he didn't, you know, bicker with family members and such, but just this eternal longing for beauty. And that was actually the biggest problem with his dying. He had finally gotten to a point that he loved where he was. He loved life. He was living life with new eyes without alcohol. And at least this is my perception. You know, I wish he was here to ask, because he would articulate something very, very interesting, I'm sure. But he was so happy with his life and living in general that that combined with the doctor's inability to propose that he might be dying ended up being kind of a difficult and surprising trek in the end. And he had gotten a diagnosis of lymphoma, and he flew to Oregon to where his daughter was. His daughter lived in Oregon, and my husband and I live in Vermont, and spent maybe a month or 6 weeks with his daughter. And they had started to go to doctor's appointments to see oncologists and to start things rolling with chemotherapy. And he was slowly becoming more confused. The Korsakoff syndrome was taking a toll on his memory, and he was getting more and more confused and wanted to just go home, go back to Chile. But there was nobody there to actually care for him on a daily basis, as much as chemotherapy was going to require. So,
and he couldn't probably live alone at that point.
Correct. He wanted to just live alone and do it himself. And this also is the trouble with anybody who's aging or anybody who is independent and terminally ill. Of course, you want to keep taking care of yourself, but it's not always possible.
Right.
So we invited him to come back home with us in Vermont. And this started to pose like its own special issues, because English was his second language, and Vermont is 99% white English speaking. So along with the onset of symptoms due to the lymphoma and the chemotherapy and eventually the radiology and the Korsakoff syndrome, he started losing the English language. And so each doctor's appointment that we were going to, I would have to slow down so that the doctor or the nurse would explain what was going on, explain the procedure. And we'd have to, I don't speak Spanish, so I would have to speak to him slowly in English in words that I knew he could understand. Of course, when his son was there, he would speak to him in Spanish because he's fully bilingual, and his daughter in Oregon is bilingual too. So there were challenges, and things started happening very rapidly. The chemotherapy at first looked like it was working. The lymphoma had shrunk and it looked like everything was going to be great. But then very quickly, there was a rapid decline. And I was surprised time after time that although they had had him write out his advance directive, they got the paperwork in order, there was still no conversation. So the advance directive conversation was along the lines of, in case something happens during your chemotherapy treatment. It was not, in case these are your last days and you're going to be dying. So it was very kind of hypothetical and set up almost as if you should have this in case there's an emergency. I had been working with the elderly. I had been there with people who were dying. I had taken death doula training classes. So I could put these things together and come at it from a logical point of view and talk to him about this, but he didn't want to talk about it. I said, Marcella, what if you're dying? What if these are your last days? Is there something that you would like to say to your son and daughter? And he said, yes, of course. But I can't remember what to say. So he had gotten to the point where he wanted to talk about meaningful things, but he had lost so much of his memory and his train of thought. He didn't think it could come out properly. And other times when I would talk to him about it, he'd say, yes, but I'm living now. In other words, why do I want to talk about dying? Because right now I'm living.
Right.
And yeah. That goes back to that beautiful, like ever positive, poetic view of life. Like, I am still living. Why would I talk about dying? And how can you argue with that?
Really?
Whenever he would say something like that, I would say, you're right. Let's get an ice cream.
Yeah. So he died in your home?
He did not die in our home. There were many trips back and forth to the emergency room. He would get dehydrated and all kinds of different things were happening, and everything was turning into a medical emergency over and over again. And I could see the writing on the wall, but the family, for the most part, didn't necessarily want to talk about it. Marcelo had gone through 2 or 3 major heart attacks, and he trusted medicine so much that I think thought he was going to get through this. The prognosis was quite good that he was, you know, should be able to get through this kind of lymphoma. So the last time that he went to the emergency room, they transferred him to another hospital, put him on a ventilator, and he never came home. But during those last few days, things were getting very serious, and the family had started to become very worried. Again, there was the language barrier, and the nursing staff had to use a translator app, and we couldn't be there all the time with him. So we had to keep calling to make sure, are you communicating with him in Spanish? He may not understand. Please keep him informed. And it wasn't until the last 24 to 48 hours that we finally had a person of color whose native language was Spanish. And she was able to communicate not only with him, but with the other relatives. So it was really powerful to have a doctor that was speaking their own language. So this whole time, you know, that the immigrant experience of dying in the United States is something that I don't really understand. I got a glimpse of it from working with my father-in-law and his family, but the rest of us, we are not we don't really understand fully. And there's not a lot of information or support for immigrants dying in the United States. And when we were there with him, everything was fine. We could advocate for him. But had he been alone, no one knows what kind of care he may have gotten, or how confusing this may have ended up being. But the last 24 hours, his daughter flew in from Oregon. The family members, just maybe like five of them or so from New York City, drove to Vermont. And we all gathered in the hospital because there had been a scheduled removal of the ventilator. So that's what this came down to, which was a very medicalized hospital death with all of the tubes and machines and beeps.
Right. And literally removing the life support.
Yes. So then that presents its own hardship, that the family then has to be the one to make the decision when the last breath will be.
Yeah, that's quite a weight to carry.
A tremendous weight. And I had all of these hopes for this beautiful home death and how this would go, and we could take care of him. But that's not what he wanted. It couldn't have been the way that I wanted it to go. He trusted doctors, and he trusted the hospital. And strangely, I think he was kind of comfortable in the hospital. To me, I walk into the ICU and I'm like, oh my God, get me out of here. But I think he saw that as a knowledgeable, supportive environment.
Right. They're doing all that is medically possible to help me right now.
Yes. And at one point, right before he was about to go on the ventilation, I asked him, I said, Marcella, would you like to come home with us? You can die at home. And he insisted that he wanted everything possible to be done. And I said, okay, that's absolutely what we will do then.
Right, because it's his call.
That's right. So in the background, over those 24 hours that the family had been gathering and coming to the hospital and getting hotels and rental cars, I had been communicating with a funeral home to help with transporting his body. So this was in January. And in Vermont, there's a lot of snow, and I didn't know when he died how we were going to transport his body. And to make arrangements would have involved the family, really, the immediate family, really taking control of and admitting what was going on. So I was doing some work in the background. I got a cardboard casket from the crematory so that we could draw on it. So his little granddaughter was now 3 years old, and we brought that. I unwrapped it in the hotel, and I broke out all the crayons and stickers, and I said, okay, come on, this is what we're going to do. We're going to send Wito for Abuelito. We're going to send Wito off in a beautiful box, this beautiful box that we're going to decorate for him. And so another thing that did make this, I don't want to say beautiful because everybody has a different perspective of, you know, this is just my story of how I saw this unfold. But everybody was gathered in the room. It was just my husband, my sister-in-law, and myself in the room when the tubes were going to be removed from Marcelo. And his two children had been talking to him and saying whatever it is that they had to say. And they each took turns alone with him. And at the end, we asked the doctor to come in and explain to Marcelo what was happening. Because although I had explained it to him, and he was, you know, sedated, but we were told he was lightly sedated, so hopefully he could hear and understand some of this. But my words, although we were very close, didn't mean as much to him as the authority of a doctor would, because he had so much faith in the medical profession. So right. The doctor came in and sat down next to Marcelo and asked my husband, how does he like to be addressed? And my husband said, well, he was a literature professor, so I think professor is how he would like to be addressed. And the doctor very beautifully told him what had happened, what the day was, what the time was, everything they had tried, that there was nothing that they could do any longer, and that when they turned off the machines, he would stop breathing and his body would die. And it was so incredibly powerful to hear that doctor speak so clearly to him. I hope, I can imagine that Marcelo very much appreciated it. And that was the end. We watched the monitors stop, you know, every button was turned off, and so all of the lights and the beeping all stopped, and we sat quietly with him until just there was the last breath and then the last heartbeat. And after that, his children wanted to leave the room. So they left, and the nursing staff came in and said, so you're welcome to leave now. We're just going to get him ready or prepare him. I'm not quite sure that the words that they used. And I said, that's okay. I can do it. And they looked at me like, what do you mean? And I said, oh no, it's okay. I'd like to care for my father-in-law, and his children agree. The family is all in support of this. And the nurse said, okay, I'll be right back. And she went to go check with the supervisor to make sure that it was okay. And before they could find the supervisor, the nursing staff was whispering out in the hallway. And I had overheard them, and I told them that, you know, very kindly, I said, don't worry, this is perfectly legal and perfectly acceptable, and you're welcome to be in the room with me if that's what you'd like, but I'm going to care for my father-in-law myself. And it took a little while, but then they were fully supportive. I don't know if anybody had asked to do that before. Certainly not on their shift, with the amount of confusion that was brought about.
You know, it's the sort of thing that might happen with death elsewhere in the hospital on a regular floor. But in the ICU, I think that their protocols are just so rigid necessarily because of the type of equipment that they're using and everything, that those nurses probably hadn't had that experience at all, you know, with a family member wanting to be actively engaged, even more present than you already were.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I was prepared that they may want us to move to another room. And of course, that was fine. So that might have been some of it also, some of the discussion, can she stay here and do this? But in the end, so I had already purchased his clothes. I went to the store and bought some clothes that in that 24 hours before his death, and got him some nice things to wear. And part of the sweet process of all of this was my 3-year-old daughter helped me pick out some of his clothes. And when we were shopping, and I said, do you think Huito will like this? Do you think he'll like this? He's going to wear it on his body and you'll see it when he's wearing it. And we got to the underwear section and there were all kinds of boxers. And there was a one pair of Lion King boxers. And I said, which ones do you think Huito would like? And she's like, oh, these. So we got him
perfect
these silk boxers with little Lion King cartoon characters on them. And it made a little smile on the nurse's face when we were putting on his Lion King boxers in the ICU.
That is classic. Did you bathe his body there? Did you do any sort of ritual bathing, or was it really just more about getting him out of the hospital gown and getting the clothing on him that you had picked out?
Yeah, I had brought with me some essential oils and some items for a shrine. I had brought an LED candle that added ambiance. So when we were washing down his body, it was myself and an ICU nurse. And I had tucked some herbs into his, the lapel of his jacket, and rubbed some essential oils on him, and, you know, packed up the shrine. So the ICU nurse got to see all of that. And in the end, she thanked me. And she said, that was so beautiful.
Thank you for describing that detail.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think it's important that people know that they can create these spaces in places like a hospital ICU room, you know, just by bringing in a few special elements and laying them out.
Yeah, there are little things that can be done to create a peaceful environment amidst chaos. And I'm thankful that I knew that. I'm thankful that I had known that ahead of time and had the clarity to be able to do that. And ICU, as you said, is usually a place of emergency and, unfortunately, terror. But when there's the opportunity to create some kind of heartfelt sanity, it should be taken. Every effort should be made to create that.
Indeed. So you prepared his body there in that room, and then the funeral home came and collected him?
That's right. The funeral home came to pick up his body, and the family and I had driven home ahead of the funeral home. I didn't want to leave his body there. I wished very much that it could have been different, that we could have taken him with us. But under the circumstances, it wasn't possible. So the best next thing that I could do is prepare the space for him to be received at home. And so I quickly got together all of the things that I had gathered, the cooling implements and the flowers and set up another shrine for him. And overnight, we kept his body cool. And in the morning, we had his home funeral. The family members came. Again, there was probably only 10 people, 10 or 15 people. And my 3-year-old daughter was very interested, she was very interested in what had happened to her grandfather. So I had talked to her about it. We all had been talking to her about it. Well, he's very sick. And eventually, as the weeks and months went on, close to the end, we had told her that he was dying. And what did that mean? And then we told her that he was dead. But then she got to see dead. And it was amazing. When the funeral home brought him, they didn't have his glasses on. And so they brought him, and he was all dressed. He looked very handsome in what we had put on him. And it wasn't until his glasses went on that I looked at him and said, "Oh, there he is." Then the image was complete, as I remembered my father-in-law. And then he was ready to have people come greet him and say hello and say, "I love you and I miss you." And I asked my daughter if she would like to touch him. My husband had carried her into the room, and they knelt down beside his body. He was on a very low table. And she said that she did not want to touch him, but she wanted to adjust things around him. So she adjusted the flowers, and she put the crystal a little closer to him, and she pulled up his blankets. And so she started doing things around him, and she kept looking and looking. But as the hours went on, pretty soon she was becoming more comfortable, to the point when, you know, somebody new would come, she'd say, "Oh, come with me. You probably want to take a look at my grandfather."
That's just the sweetest thing, that she took it at her own pace, and that you, as her parents, invited her into the space but didn't expect anything of her, and she just figured it out on her own. I love that she was inviting people in to see him.
She became the host. She said, "Yes, there's definitely something to see in here, and you're probably going to want to see it." It was very charming. And overall, you know, the family was so happy that this was a possibility. They're all Spanish-speaking individuals. And to have a white English-speaking stranger funeral director lead the funeral would not have felt right. So this was in their own space. They could take their own time. They could speak their own language. Nobody was going to be questioning anything at all. And it was so beautiful that I wish that it was a possibility for everybody. And everybody was able to partake in a home funeral, if not of your own family, then of somebody else's, so you can get the opportunity to see how it could be. My husband said that he just wished we could have kept his body with us longer.
So how long was he at home?
He was with us at home for maybe 15 hours, but we had already made arrangements with the funeral home to come pick him back up again. So I wish that it could have been longer. I think everybody wished we could. At first, you know, people think it's so strange. Oh my gosh, you're going to have a body in your house. That's so weird. And then, you know, when the body is there, it becomes very natural. And then you miss the person all over again. You know, like, it's the last thing, the last goodbye. And So you were sad when he died, but then there's this really special sadness, this full sadness of when the body goes. Oh, it made me cry just thinking about it.
Yeah, because you've just had these last moments in the presence of his physical body. And when it goes away, there it is a deep sorrow. It's so final. Now, you had decorated the cardboard box for his cremation. And that was there in the home. Did you move him into the box?
The box. Gosh, I'm trying to remember now. Yes. So we decorated the box in the hotel. And so we brought the box home with us again. I just knew it was going to be a good activity for our 3-year-old daughter to be engaged in, something that she could participate in and recognize. So then when we came home, we set up the cardboard box again. And my older children and some of the other family members drew on it also while Marcelo's body was in the room. It's nice to have an art project, something for people to do and to just kind of mindlessly work on. In the end, when we were transporting his body, we carried his body from the hearse into the house and then back into the hearse again. And his box accompanied him. And he went into the cardboard box just before going into the crematorium.
Is there anything that you would offer to people who are considering this, but maybe a little nervous about it or wondering if it's right for them?
Absolutely. I wish to give people the confidence to do this, to fumble through it, to not know what you're doing, and to know that that's perfectly fine. So I think we are at a point where people think that you need to hire somebody. You need to bring in a death doula. You need to bring in a home funeral guide. You need to use this external source to give you the confidence to care for your dead. And it's easy for me to say because I've read about it and I've worked with the dying and the dead. But you realize that you don't need anybody. You need somebody with a clear head, but that it's okay to do this in your home if you're so fortunate to have the ability, the time, the support, that you're not going to hurt the body. You're going to be okay doing this. It's going to be really awkward. But aside from that clear-headed individual that knows what the laws are, families can do this and fumble through it in their very awkward way, and that's part of the healing process.
Right. And if we plan in advance and seek out that information we need, seek out the people in our communities that have the information, that know what the laws are, and sort of give you a roadmap to how this can be done. But I love the point that you're making, that it's okay to fumble through it as well.
Yeah, it's okay. You know, dressing a dead body is very awkward. And you don't know how awkward until you actually do it.
Right.
And it's okay. You're not going to hurt them. You're going to do the best that you can. And reaching out to a community member is something beautiful. And I'm not saying don't ask some, you know, don't go to quote unquote right. Somebody who's professional, just that have the confidence that you're going to be able to do this with many heads together and thinking things out. You're going to be able to figure it out. And it's not that You can't do it because you don't have the cooling implements. It's not that you can't do it because you've never done it before. Figure it out. Find some cooling implements. You probably have things in your freezer. Somebody can run to the drugstore.
Yeah, right. We can figure it out. Well, Anne Marie, thank you so much for sharing this story with us.
Thank you for listening. Thank you for being willing to air it and to share it, because the immigrant experience of dying is not always talked about. There's a woman named Tita Beatty, who's Thai American, and she has just started compiling the immigrant stories of dying in the U.S., and I think it's going to be very important for all of us to understand.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that you reached out to share this story. The more variety that we hear about in these stories, the more normalized this practice will become. And so I really value what you've shared with us today. A Path Home is a production of the National Home Funeral Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to educating and advocating for communities and families who choose to care for their own loved ones at death. Check out our website at homefuneralalliance.org. If you like this podcast, be sure to tell a friend and subscribe and review wherever you get your podcasts. If you would like to share your home funeral or natural burial experience on the podcast, please email me at podcast@homefuneralalliance.org. We'd love to hear from you. The music at the beginning and end of A Path Home is written and performed by Sarah Cruz. Our beautiful cover art is by Linda Curray. And until next time, remember the words of Ram Dass. We are all walking each other home.
I want to be there to walk you home. I'll tend to your body, you'll tend to my soul. And if it happens, I know you'll gently lay me in the ground and take the next breath.